Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Shallow Dive, coming to you pre-recorded from our bunker here. Alex, have you bought plenty of Lurol?
Yep, the house is well stocked. We've got Lurol, hand sanitizer. You know where to come if you need your hands sanitized.
It's stay indoors. Stay indoors, wash your hands. Indoors, wash your hands. That is the Shallow Dive official advice.
That's the message that we're sending to you. If you take away nothing else from this podcast, wash your damn hands.
Stay inside and listen to excellent new political podcasts.
Who needs to go to work when you can just listen to us all day, yes, every day? Catch up on back episodes mentioning no members of the family.
And big shout out to all the freelance journalists out there who self-isolate nearly every day and don't need to really change their behaviour.
Yeah, it's down to you that the nation is staying afloat.
So this week, Alex, we are going to finally talk about Corona.
We've put it off for long enough.
We think there's been enough of a big political and economic effect to really take a shallow, deep dive into it.
Indeed.
So here we go.
Get hyped. All right. So as trailed in the intro, this is the long-awaited coronavirus episode. We've avoided it for weeks, but now here it is. The takes you've been waiting for from us.
A couple of armchair experts.
Indeed.
There's plenty of them out there, aren't there? Yeah. I'm not a health expert, but I think...
But here's an 11-tweet thread.
Of how we should respond to this global health crisis.
So, Murray, do you want to just, give an overview of how screwed we are?
I'd give it a solid 9.5 out of 10.
Okay.
For the current situation.
Okay.
Italy, particularly, is looking very bad, and their whole country is on shutdown. They've had a reported 631 deaths, the latest stats that we can see. Mm-hmm. And their 60 million population is on shutdown, sort of mass quarantine almost in the towns and cities across the country.
Yeah.
In the UK, however, we're being a much more lackadaisical about it, would you say, Alex?
Yeah. So, the virus is growing exponentially. So we've currently had only, I think, 6 deaths so far in the UK, but we've had 383 cases, and it's thought we're only sort of maybe 1 or 2 weeks behind where Italy is now. Mm-hmm. So quickly get a lot worse. So there's been a lot of controversy because we are currently doing much less to combat the virus than a lot of other countries. We're taking much less drastic measures than Italy, which has closed all of its schools. The entire country, as you said, is on lockdown. The UK instead is relying a lot more on behavioural science because they think if they do panic-inducing measures, it will actually just make everything worse. It will mm-hmm. backfire. The public won't actually respond to it. So they're trying sort of subtler messages, public health information campaigns to try and just get people to wash their hands more. And I reckon that will slow the virus down mm-hmm. and be more effective. But it's really controversial because nobody's ever tried to combat a pandemic like this before. But then we haven't had many pandemics, so who knows?
There haven't been many trial runs.
No, exactly. But it's a risk, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. The UK, it's been a slower response, but they've at least been on top of it, I'd say.
Yeah.
It's definitely a priority.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, questionably, in the US, it has not been the top priority of government.
If there was one country you would... Well, I mean, you wouldn't really want to be in China, Italy, or Iran right now. but the US seems to be dealing with it spectacularly badly, because you look at the official stats, and the US has only got 1,016 cases and 31 deaths, but it's thought that might be major underreporting of the overall number mm-hmm. of cases and deaths because they just aren't testing anybody. The number of tests they're doing is only about 5 per million in the population, which is hugely lower than other countries.
Yeah.
They just don't seem to have prepared for this eventuality. Their health system is awfully designed for it because there's people who have gone and got tested and then been presented with bills for many thousands of dollars in medical fees. It's crazy.
And then, so people are being put off from going to get tested because they're worried about having to wrangle with their insurance company.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you see there was a news story the other day that Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York State, was going to give free tests for everybody, but these would be made free because they would be cheaply produced by prison labour.
Okay. Well, he's a problem solver.
He's
a practical thinker.
Yeah.
I give him that. What's interesting, the discussion in the US that Trump has pinned his success to the stock market for his presidency, and obviously that has tumbled huge amount. On Monday, it had its biggest loss since the financial crash in 2008. It lost 8% value in one day, the S&P 500.
It was the fifth worst day of the stock markets of all time since records began.
So he seems more bothered about that than the actual spread of the disease, the prevention of the spread. So it's been interesting to look at what some of the economic solutions or preventative measures have been suggested in the US. So one of the measures that Trump likes is a payroll tax cut, which essentially income tax cut in the US.
Yeah.
And that puts a bit more money into people's pockets when they're not spending.
Yeah.
And that will encourage them to go out and spend and keep the economy afloat. Yeah. But some are saying that that is too slow a measure, won't have the necessary impact. So some people are suggesting a huge fiscal stimulus is the only way that the economy could get through this. So some have suggested giving $1,000 to every adult, plus $500 for every child in a family.
Sounds great.
And so this would cost about $350 billion, but it would thought that people would really be encouraged to spend.
Yeah.
So that's one of the biggest effects or the scares about the economies of the world in general, is that if you're on lockdown and you're worried about the future, you are just not going to purchase anything apart from the bare essentials.
Yeah. Yeah. So the issue with a payroll tax cut is obviously that if people are really worried about this, you know, plague spreading across the world, maybe they get a bit more money, but maybe they just save that because they're worried about the future and they're worried about having to self-isolate. And similar issues with the universal basic income thing. You know, you give people money and people probably just like stash it under their pillow. So like a government stimulus is probably going to be more effective at the end of the day. But then he's a Republican, so his party doesn't really like that at the moment.
He also floated the idea of offering loans to small businesses through the government. And the Federal Reserve also indicated that they would allow banks to be flexible with customers if they fell behind on loan payments and things like that.
Yeah.
Which we saw that in Italy the other day, didn't they? They've announced that mortgage payments can be suspended.
Across the entire country.
Yeah.
Which is incredible. And of course, we are currently recording as the budget is being announced. So we have no information on what Rishi Sunak's measures to combat the coronavirus will be. But you, dear listener.
We encourage you to go out and read the news.
Yeah, we encourage you to open up BBC News. Yeah. Other news outlets are available.
I did see the exciting lead that £2.5 billion will be put into filling potholes around the country.
I do love a good filled pothole.
Moving swiftly on.
Yeah.
The other huge economic effect is the price of oil's down, Alex. Isn't this great news for the consumer?
Well, so this all started on March the 6th when the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, announced it would slash oil production because of the coronavirus. So this is a big international cartel of 14 states, mostly Middle Eastern, some West African, several in the northern part of South America. And they are in this group which always moves together in their oil production to control oil prices. And that gives them a lot of geopolitical influence. And in recent years, they've often worked in coordination with Russia, which also produces a huge amount of oil. So on March the 6th, OPEC said they would slash oil production because of the coronavirus. The coronavirus had destroyed demand for fuel, especially from China. And the research firm IHS Market predicted that oil demand would suffer its steepest decline on record in the first quarter, worse than the 2008 financial crisis. So OPEC, so they announced they would slash production because of this, because there was just too much oil. The global demand just wasn't there to buy the oil that they were producing. But Russia refused to back the plan, blowing up the alliance with OPEC that they had been in recent years. And as a result, Saudi Arabia, when they saw Russia doing that, immediately decided they would increase production and slash prices. So now in the price war with Russia.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a who blinks first game of chicken between them.
Yeah, so it's quite a standoff. And one of the big fallouts that some have said is that it's going to hurt developing countries who rely on crude oil production and selling to fund their economy.
Yeah.
You know, Saudi Arabia and Russia can take a short-term hit of a 30% cut in the price of oil, right? But smaller oil-producing countries really can't.
Yeah. And the other people who can't handle low oil prices is oil men in the US, which is currently the world's biggest oil producer, surpassed Russia in 2018. But nearly all of the US oil is produced by shale fracking, which is a really expensive process. So it's only profitable when the oil price is high. So by increasing production, lowering oil prices, Russia hopes to put loads of these shale firms out of business in the US. And doing this because they're annoyed at the US's market position overtaking Russia, and also because the US just the other week put on even more sanctions against Russians, Russian oligarchs, Russian politicians, Russian companies. So they're annoyed at the US. They increase production, slashing prices. That puts loads of oil firms in the US out of business. Also puts loads of pressure on US banks, which have lent money to these oil firms.
Right.
So it could have a massive impact on the US economy, even though short-term impact, it's great because it means people can use their cars more. You know, oil makes the world go round.
Yeah. So as I was reading about this, I found a great quote from someone.
You read about this?
Yeah. Fatih Birol, who ran the International Energy Agency in Paris. And he said that Russia and Saudi Arabia's behavior was irresponsible, and accused them of callous disregard for the threat of the virus, right? Because this is a time where we need economic stability as much as possible. So he said, the world is facing a major challenge in fighting against coronavirus. I find it at best irresponsible that they're having a price war now. The people of the world will not forget who was on the side of fighting the virus and which countries were on the side of making the fight more difficult.
Well, if anything's going to make Vladimir Putin worried about his international position, it's the International Energy Agency.
But in a sort of apocalyptic scenario, or let's say semi-apocalyptic.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think seeing Russia and Saudi Arabia even not bounding together a little bit to help, or, you know, just trying to profit off a crisis, a global crisis, I think could do long-term damage
it,
to
them. It might be really short-sighted. And like a global recession will not do anybody any favours. So, bad Putin.
So, bringing it back to a bit more of a micro level, I was reading about a man in Rome who runs a cafe near the Trevi Fountain. And he said business is down 80%.
Only meant to be a shallow dive, man. We're now like listing the fortunes of each Rome cafe. Sorry.
And I found it interesting that this is sort of an unprecedented impact on Italy, a developed nation. In peacetime, the country's on shutdown. We talked about the mortgage payments being suspended, but people are being ordered to stay home and they have to seek permission for essential travel. And basically the effect on Italy is going to be disastrous. Even before the lockdown, it was facing a fourth recession in a decade. And there's only been minimal growth in the living standards in the last two decades in Italy. Yeah. Its manufacturing sector is just full of low-cost producers, which are vulnerable to disruptions in the global supply chain. And the government debt is high. Its banking system is weak. And it's a strategically important economy in the Eurozone. It's the Eurozone's third biggest economy, yet it's still so vulnerable.
Yeah.
So the wider point is, when Italy falls, the Eurozone
falls.
It's even a bigger impact than Greece's collapse.
And the Eurozone only had 0.1% growth in the last quarter of 2019. So it's already quite fragile, sort of teetering on the edge.
And so if it was to remain on kind of lockdown, or if the economy was immobilized until June, their prediction of a 4.5% drop in GDP in their second quarter, which would be not just a recession. That's a big old recession right there.
Thick. Anyway, so to the broader point of whether a recession is coming, I think I was reading about this, and essentially the answer is nobody knows in terms of the global picture, because obviously there's going to be a significant knock on growth in China. Europe's not looking great. We just don't know how widespread the virus is in the US. US, previously, the economy was pretty robust, but if it has a massive outbreak there, who knows? And economic indicators all tend to lag. So you only tend to have a recession announced after it's already been happening for several months. Not great. And as well as that, we don't know if the virus is going to be seasonal or not. So as temperatures rise, they will eventually rise. That's what happens every year. The virus just might stop spreading as quickly and might not cause as many fatalities, which would be great.
And conversely, because the virus is an exponential thing, so as we've said, the measures and the models you use to measure the effect on the economy is so unpredictable.
Just a tiny mathematical error can cause several weeks difference in how fast the virus is spreading.
Yeah, so the margin of error
is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, the message here is we just don't know what's happening.
Okay, so amidst this global pandemic that we're currently or going to experience in the next few weeks, everything's sort of a lesser covered story.
Yep.
But we've still been looking for those little nuggets of news around the world. So, Alex, you're going to take us to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I am. This is a purge that has been happening in Riyadh among the Saudi royal family. This all started when the Wall Street Journal reported on Friday that masked guards with the royal court arrested Prince Ahmed, the king's younger brother, and his son, and also Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who is the former army head of intelligence and the king's nephew, and also two brothers of Mohammed bin Nayef and his nephew Abdul Aziz, who is the interior minister. So, and then on Saturday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the purge had widened to dozens of interior ministry officials, senior army officers, and others interpreted as supporting a coup attempt. This is kind of not the first purge that has happened in Saudi Arabia in recent years. So Al Jazeera said that the detentions raised speculation about King Salman's health and whether the Crown Prince's accession to the throne was imminent. So this is, the Crown Prince is Mohammed bin Salman. He became Crown Prince in 2017. He is the current king's son, and he has been sort of consolidating power in recent years, and he's thought essentially to be the kind of de facto ruler at this point, making all the key decisions. But his position is still not quite secure. He was only made Crown Prince in 2017. It's quite unusual in Saudi Arabia for the land succession to pass from father to son. There more usually passes from brother to brother, or has done for around a century now. So there's a lot of people angry about him being appointed Crown Prince in the Saudi royal family, and who worry that he won't be a very good ruler because he brought international condemnation when he murdered Jamal Khashoggi and has also got Saudi Arabia involved in a very costly war in Yemen, which has resulted in a huge number of lives lost and doesn't seem to have any end in sight. So, yeah, endless purges in Saudi Arabia.
So how many people has he purged, do you think? Is there a figure out there?
Dozens was the was the word going around the news articles.
Okay. And these would typically be rival people, aristocratic kind of oligarchic people.
Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, I think, is so he's the nephew of the king and is considered a rival to the throne. And he's also considered somebody who he's the prince who's basically in charge of counterterrorism. So he has a lot of links with Western allies. So it's thought he would have quite a lot of support if he did try to make a play for the throne. A lot of support among international allies. A lot of European heads of state and the US might support him if he were to try to become king instead of Mohammed bin Salman.
So very dangerous as a rival.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, very interesting stuff. Now, I'm going to take you over to a much smaller country, but also one that's well indentured with oil.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Guyana.
Right.
In South America, one of the smallest countries in South America, population of just 800,000.
Mm-hmm.
They've just had some elections.
All right.
And guess what? The result has been disputed. So the incumbent is David Granger of the People's National Congress. He was up against the opposition PPP party, led by Ifan Ali. It was billed to be close, but the PPP party are questioning the results, a specific Region 4, as it's been called, where it was expected that the incumbent would win, but the margin of victory has been raised as suspicious. And that margin of victory is what was pushed them over to him claiming the overall victory for the presidency. So it's a really important election in Guyana, this one, because there's just been a huge discovery of oil in their territory.
Just what the world needs, more oil.
Yep, so ExxonMobil is planning to tap into 8 billion barrels of oil and gas off the country's coast.
Wow.
But the country is quite divided politically. Since it became independent from the UK in 1966, it's been divided mainly on ethnic lines.
Right.
With the Grangers, the incumbent's coalition is based off the black Guyanese, descended from African slaves, while the PPP mostly represents descendants of Indian labourers who were brought over in the 19th century. Yeah. It's a very interesting history to that country, as I was discovering, reading about this story. The incumbents had promised to use the oil wealth to finance cash transfers to citizens, as well as investing in infrastructure and diversification of the economy. But the PPP said the incumbent had given too much to ExxonMobil, allowed them to keep too much of the oil revenue.
Right.
So this is a hotly disputed election, especially given the context, because this is the moment whichever party in charge is going to transform the country with the oil wealth. So really, really interesting one. And but it resulted in police surrounding the Electoral Commission, which is never a good look.
Never a good look. No.
So yeah, one to watch out for on that, because that's still disputed.
Great. Well, from one disputed election to another, we are now heading over to Afghanistan. I'm just going to read the New York Times lead from this because it was very good. Just a few minutes and a thin wall apart, both President Ashraf Ghani and his chief rival, Abdullah Abdullah, took the oath of office as the president of Afghanistan on Monday, plunging the fragile country into a new crisis during sensitive peace talks. So this is essentially, elections were held quite a while ago now, in September, and the results were delayed amid protests and allegations of fraud. And then days after the election, both candidates declared victory despite not having any evidence for this. Results were finally released in December and showed President Ghani with 50.64% of the vote and Dr. Abdullah Abdullah with 39.52% of the vote. But Dr. Abdullah accuses Mr. Ghani of pressuring the Election Commission to rush the process of auditing questionable votes. He disputes about 15% of the votes. The crucial thing is that in order to form a majority, Mr. Ghani needs a minimum of 50% of the vote, and he was only over that threshold by a margin of 12,000 votes. So it's very, very thin. He only just has enough support, he says, to be able to form a majority government without Dr. Abdullah being involved. And obviously, two people being sworn in as president simultaneously in rival ceremonies happening at the same time as we talked about last week, as the US just signing a deal with the Taliban. So not a great time for there to be divided government, or, you know, sort of questionable whether there is a government at the moment at all. And at the same time, 50% of Afghans are below the poverty line, unemployment is 25%, and coronavirus is obviously rampant in Iran next door and beginning to spread in Afghanistan. So they really need a government.
Wouldn't be good.
Not a great time. There's never a great time to not have a government, but this is especially bad.
Oh. Well, it's not looking good for them then.
No. No.
Well, in more positive news,
mm-hmm.
Going over to Canada.
I'm just a doom monger this week.
Yeah.
I've got a nice cheery story coming up next about Lebanese debt crisis.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. Anyway, Canada.
So this is better news, mm-hmm. certainly. So in Canada, they've taken the first big legislative step to ban or criminalise conversion therapy.
Mm.
For those that don't know, conversion therapy is essentially not a therapy. It's a method of sort of bullying LGBT people into reconsidering or questioning their sexuality or identity. This happens a lot in religiously conservative countries, where you hear about a lot of it in the US and Canada, where you've got a real mix of fundamentalist conservative religious people, but also a very modern progressive wider hub within the country. So you kind of get this conflict where people are confident enough to sort of tell their family they're gay, but the family are also confident enough in their religion that there's these whole industries that set up, go almost like, you know, a rehab for your gay child, right?
And it's actually so, you know, culturally conservative countries or communities where the law forbids you from locking these people up, essentially.
Yeah, right. conversion therapists, right, I think they're quite entrepreneurial, and they see that there's this kind of market for twisting the idea that your family member who's gay is just a phase, or it's just flippant, or it's just...
Conversion therapy is, of course, a very current thing in the UK as well, happens here as well, and just as much a controversial issue here, and I think it's still legal here.
It's still legal. It's sort of condemned by government and health and cultural bodies
and
here, but
groups,
it's seen as so there's an issue with consent, right?
Yeah,
with it, because if you want to go and spend a week at a camp or, you know, whatever, you're free to do that. So what Canada has done is that the legislation would make it illegal to make a minor, a child, to go to conversion therapy because they can't consent to it.
Yeah.
It would, taking a minor out of the country to go to that therapy, cause a person, an adult, to go to conversion therapy against their will.
Which presumably would already be illegal, with like coercion.
harder to prove, I suppose, I guess, by making a specific law against it.
Clarifying a legal ambiguity.
Yeah. And then from the business side, you cannot profit from providing conversion therapy and you cannot advertise conversion therapy whatsoever.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's kind of cracking down on the people trying to sell other people things they don't need.
Yeah.
Trying to crack down on that side of it.
Yeah, I suppose. I guess it still opens the window that if it was a not-for-profit thing, this could still happen. But then politician this, Mr. Lametti, he did say that the bill didn't want to overreach and target conversations about sexuality or gender identity with teachers, counsellors, faith leaders or mental health professionals, right? So, yeah, you don't want to be over-prescriptive and say you can't have open discussions about sexuality and things like that.
It's such a difficult subject, I think, because obviously the vast majority of conversion therapy, I think the science fairly conclusively shows is very harmful. And I think LGBT rights groups are completely right in condemning it. It's been awful, awful cases, you know, in the US in the 20th century of, you know, gay people being electrically shocked to try and supposedly cure them of being gay, which is obviously awful. But there are nonetheless also some people who do claim to have been converted. You know, they claim that they have gone from gay to straight. And, you know, is that just because sexuality is fluid? Did it really work? You know, I mean, and also, if you do consent, if you do really want to do this, does that show that you are, you know, suffering from some kind of internalized homophobia? Or are you just a person free acting and choosing to do as you wish through the world? So I wouldn't advise anybody to do the practice. I certainly would not wish to go through it myself as somebody in that community. I think it's good that they're cracking down on trying to coerce people into it and minors, but it is a really complicated issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you bring it back to a wider freedom and liberty point of view, there's terrible, you know, therapies that do nothing all over, and we should be reluctant to ban those completely, shouldn't we? Because, again, it's people's free choice to do them.
But I mean, there's another point of view which says that if it's making their lives worse, you know, maybe we should just, maybe they don't know what's best for themselves. I don't know.
No. They don't necessarily know what's best for themselves, but they have the freedom to make mistakes.
Yeah. I guess there's a question about informed consent and whether they're being fully informed of the risks to them psychologically. You know, that's how most conversion therapy is done these days, is through psychological techniques rather than electrodes being strapped to the body. But that can, you know, cause psychological trauma for life if it goes wrong, which it often does. I think it's probably more cases of it going wrong than right. You know?
Yeah.
So how do you test whether somebody's adequately informed of the psychological risks? Anyway, I think we should probably move on.
Yes. I believe there's a debt crisis in Lebanon.
There is a debt crisis in Lebanon. Yep. Lebanon is defaulting on its debts for the first time in its history. That's the first for everything. March the 7th.
And why does this matter, Alex? I'm going to prompt you with that.
Well, hang on. Can I just give us the overview first? On March the 7th, Prime Minister... Well, because we care about Lebanon, anyway. on March the 7th, Prime Minister Hassan Diab announced his country would not repay a $1.2 billion Eurobond due 2 days later. He said, I'll quote, how can we pay the creditors while there are people in the streets without the money to buy a loaf of bread? That's a pretty good point. So essentially, there's been an economic crisis there for several months. There's huge inflation. Lebanese government debt is 150% of GDP. Banks are not letting people withdraw more than $50 each week in some places because they haven't got the money to give their customers the money that they've deposited in the bank. Debit cards as well have often had restrictions imposed upon them. Unemployment is thought was around 25% even before the crisis, and around 40% of Lebanese live in poverty, so it's a pretty grim picture. And in October, there were huge protests against incompetence and corruption, which brought down a previous government. But the good news is that banks are still honouring checks, which has led to an odd boomlet, The Economist says, in luxury goods as clients snap up property, Rolexes, and high-end cars. Because that's the only thing you can buy.
Nice. Well, it's a nice win for the little guy.
Yeah. But your question as to why it mattered.
Yes.
Essentially, 2/3 of government debt is held by local banks in Lebanon. So the government defaulting has huge knock-on effects for them. means that they might run into troubles of their own. Basically, the aim of defaulting on your debt is that the hope is that you can then restructure your debt, which means renegotiating terms on which it is paid back. So you might look at that and think, well, that will help Lebanon. But actually, around 25% of Lebanon's debt is now held by foreigners who might block an attempt to restructure.
Mm.
So they might not even be able to get any of the good effects from this default that they want if they can't even restructure their debt. So that'd be bad. And they'll probably have to get an IMF loan, which would involve the IMF will probably demand that they raise taxes and raise fuel prices. So it'll just make everything even more miserable. So not good in Lebanon. And of course, last week we talked about refugees a lot, and Lebanon is the main recipient of refugees from Syria, being in the country next door. So there's huge refugee camps all across Lebanon right now, and that has not helped the situation one bit.
Very interesting stuff. Okay. The only thing I've heard about Lebanon, aside from this, is in Beirut, it's becoming quite a popular spot for wealthy expats around the world to go and live and work.
Mm-hmm.
It's become a bit of a trendy hotspot to hear about all this terrible suffering.
You now get travel tips on the Shallow Dive.
It just shows a contrast of some of the privileged worlds that exist.
Yeah.
In different bubbles.
Yeah. Moving on to the next segment. Coming right up. All right. And now for our debate segment. And this week we are returning to the climate issue, which I think is generally a good thing to do, because if it's not in the headlines, it should be. So this is a good way to return attention to a topic that is eating away at this planet, even when it's not causing major headline news. Don't you think?
No.
Okay. Right.
Sorry, anyway. I'm just getting into character.
Yeah. So the debate topic for this week is Extinction Rebellion have done more harm than good. This refers to the protest movement that was formed in May 2018 with the aim of using non-violent civil disobedience to compel government action to avoid tipping points in the climate system. And yes, I am reading out from Wikipedia. So Murray is going to be the proposer of this motion. Extinction Rebellion have obviously had a lot of high-profile protests, basically shutting down London and several other cities all over the world. A lot of big ones this autumn. Take it away, Murray.
Okay, so my argument is going to be formed in two parts.
Mm-hmm.
The first is to talk about the harms that Extinction Rebellion have done,
mm-hmm.
but the other is to focus on undermining the goods that they have achieved. So if we take that first, so Extinction Rebellion credit themselves with bringing climate and green politics to the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
It's making far more people aware of it and far more people politically active about it and pushing governments to take more immediate action. I would argue, however, that this is a bit of a chicken and egg situation. And actually, Extinction Rebellion are a symptom of people being more politically aware and engaged with it, and governments already taking more action to combat climate change. We already had ambitious net zero targets, switching to electric vehicles, getting rid of dependency on coal. All these things, they're all happening already. And Extinction Rebellion, the best of intentions, didn't actually achieve half the things that they sort of credit themselves with. So the goods, that good level is way reduced from what you're going to suggest, Alex. The other side is the harms that they cause now. Their mass protests, they call them protests. They were basically just big parties in cities around the world. Any excuse to have a good time and not go to work. Isn't that right, Alex?
Of course.
So again, they're crediting themselves with taking a day off work, having a party. I walked through Trafalgar Square one day when it was going on. It was just a lot of people in tents, full of their own self-importance and talking to each other. Again, I don't think that achieved very much apart from making it far more difficult for me to enjoy my day out in London with a friend who was visiting from abroad. Simultaneously as well, they actually affected lots of working people. For example, the people who climbed on top of the trains at Canning Town and stopped that train from moving. People late for work might not be able to turn up for their, gigs that they're going to get paid for. People on 0 hours contract. All those kind of things have serious knock-on effects for people's lives. And another big harm they do is they turn people off from climate politics themselves. The harms are numerous and varied.
well, it's so rare that you get the pleasure of hearing somebody who's just wrong in every way like that. It's incredible. Well, firstly, Murray, I think you're entirely wrong as to your assessment on how well we're responding to the climate crisis. Having targets is all well and good, but at the moment we don't seem to be doing much to actually meet those targets. The budget is being announced today, and as part of the budget, Rishi Sunak has announced that there will once more be a freeze on fuel duty. How on earth can you announce a net zero target for 2050 and then say that fuel duty will once again be freezed? We need to dramatically cut down on our transport emissions, and that's just not going to happen if taxes stay the same. We need urgent action, and we need it now. Then even the targets have been kind of slapdash, done at the last minute. The net zero target was only brought in as one of Theresa May's final acts, and it was only brought in because it's something she could very easily do in the dying days of her administration. It's not as if the Tories are ever really going to commit to this properly without severe external pressure from campaign groups like Extinction Rebellion. And you saw with the Heathrow court case just the other week that the government is not thinking clearly in a strategic way about how on earth it's going to implement this target. The target isn't filtering through into everyday government policy. It's a disaster. So external pressure is clearly needed. Then, I mean, quite frankly, you sound a little bit like the neoliberal elite there, Murray, when you complain in an individualistic way about how it's affecting your life and making it inconvenient for you to travel around. There's no way of raising awareness without making it inconvenient for some people. You're just not thinking about the bigger issue. And you look at the stats, and Extinction Rebellion, you know, in collaboration with Greta, for sure, they can't take the sole credit, but you look at the stats and public concern in the UK over climate change hasn't risen dramatically at the same time that Extinction Rebellion's big marquee protests started. It is now the second, I think, biggest issue that UK voters care about, second only to Europe and Brexit at the moment, which is really saying something, considering that it doesn't really make the news that much, considering there is this kind of low-burning thing in the background that's going to destroy us all without us even noticing. It should be headline news. Extinction Rebellion make it headline news. By making it headline news, they make people care about it, and that is a massively good thing. Yeah, they might turn a few people off along the way, but there's far more people who care about climate change. They just forget about it in their everyday lives, and they bring awareness to it. And yeah, maybe they overstate a few of their claims, but all to the greater good.
Okay, I'm glad you raised media coverage and growing concern amongst the population. Well, firstly, in terms of the media coverage, I think it's disingenuous to say climate change isn't covered in the news. I think while the media were too slow to pick it up as for the importance it had, I think over the last 2 to 3 years, it's actually been very, very good in promoting stories and pushing them up that have addressed...
2 to 3 years, that's almost like when Extinction Rebellion started protesting.
Correlation doesn't equal causation, Alex. Well, more media coverage may have improved Extinction Rebellion's support. Mm. You know, could see it as the other way around.
A virtuous circle.
And yeah, as particularly Channel 4 News, which is one of the most watched ones in the UK, have made a specific, deliberate editorial stance to tackle climate stories with much more depth. And the other side, when you talk about raising concern amongst the population, when it comes to harm that Extinction Rebellion have done, I think the harm to this nation's children has been remarkable and worrying. We now have its own term, climate change anxiety, which many school children are now experiencing because they've been taught about climate change or preached about it by angry climate Extinction Rebellion activists in such a doomsday, angry, petrifying way that many of our children genuinely feel the apocalypse is around the corner and there's nothing they can do about it. That kind of mass anxiety amongst a young population is a huge harm.
I understand the accusation there that there's, you know, unreasonable level of anxiety being caused, that obviously we're not going to become extinct and their very name is Extinction Rebellion. I understand all that. And I think in an ideal world, we'd be sitting down having a nice, reasonable discussion, much as we are now in this very studio. But that's not the world in which we live, Murray. Nobody pays attention. If you make your arguments in nuanced, realistic, reasoned ways. It's only by shouting as loudly as you can that you get people to pay attention. And you look at monthly tracking polls of which issues Britons care about, and you can genuinely see a difference from month to month. Extinction Rebellion start doing their protests in the spring of 2019, and it jumps, and it remains at that level, public concern over climate change. So I really do think there is actually evidence that there is causation, not just correlation, between the protests and...
And your evidence for that is the correlation?
My evidence for that is that you're pointing to long-term factors, but I'm saying even in the short term, monthly polling, you can see a big difference, like straight after the the climate strike.
Okay. Well, I'd just like to close by saying I think people have been slowly becoming more aware about climate change, mm-hmm. more angry about it, more urgency being put on government to do something about it. And I think we got off to a slow start, but I think in a UK context, we're in a relatively good position now with the priority of green-friendly policies. I question Extinction Rebellion's credibility when they say that they were the cause of that. And I would also like to reiterate the many harms that they are doing to the working class and the children around this country.
Well, for my closing argument, I'm going to say that you're mad. We've done the easy bit, essentially. We've invested in renewable energy. We've had a massive expansion of wind and solar in this country. But now comes the hard bit. Now the remaining obstacles to reaching carbon neutrality are transport sector and homes. We need to have a vast retrofitting program across the country where we make homes much more energy efficient. That's going to be insulation, that's going to be double glazing. It's going to cost a huge amount more than what we've done to date. And we need to rapidly find carbon-free forms of transport. It's just going to be so much harder than what we've done so far. The government is not really thinking through about how to do it. We need to do everything we can. We need to throw everything we've got at this problem to try and raise awareness. And Extinction Rebellion is a crucial part of that.
So we'll swiftly say goodbye this week and we'll head for a swift one down at the pub.
Yep.
Great news coming out of the budget. Mm-hmm. This is breaking news.
Live reaction podcast right here.
Pints will be no more expensive at your local pub unless the manager has decided to increase the price themselves. Because
<Good to clap. laughs>
beer, wine and cider duties have been frozen by Rishi Sunak.
Yeah.
Also known as Dishy Sunak. By civil servants, apparently.
Really?
He's a bit of a fox.
Wow.
In person.
Good.
That's
good to
just
know.
What I read in the morning emails.
Travel advice and dating advice on Shallow Dive.
There you go. You get it all. So, yeah, pubs will see a business rate discount rise from £1,000 to £5,000. Mm-hmm. Business rate is tax that you pay depending on the size and type of property you have. And, yep, so that's going to be good because pubs and restaurants were going to be some of the hardest hit by corona, right? People won't want to go outside.
Oh, yeah. No social gatherings.
Mingle with other infected people. But now they will because you won't have to pay one pence more on your £5.20 pint in London.
Exactly. It's all about weighing up the pros and cons. Will you die? Or how cheap a pint does it have to be worth it, do you think, if you're in a corona-infected area?
It's a good question. I'd have to think about it long. I'd probably say £2.50 pint of lager. I'll risk
I think it. I would happily risk coronavirus for sub £2, definitely.
Yeah.
I think that would be...
You should come to the Half Moon in Stepney Green. £1.50 pints there.
Out. Anyway, I think that's it from us this week.
Yeah, good luck out there.
Please,
or in
yeah.
In your little self-contained bubble.
Please promote the podcast, send it to a friend, rate and review, like us on Twitter, on Facebook, do whatever you can.
Shout out to our listener in Virginia.
Ashburn, Virginia.
Yeah.
We love you. We hope you love us.
And you'll hear from us next week.
Yeah, I think we're off to the pub.
All right. Bye-bye.
See ya.